just right on time. So we just released the 5-year results from WMAP yesterday, day before yesterday. And papers are all up in archive now. We have 7 papers, and starting from the basic results paper and the systematic error analysis, beam, we have some big improvement in beam, and how do we subtract the foreground, how do we subtract the sources, how do we measure angular power spectrum and results for the power spectrum analysis, then how do we convert that to the parameters and parameters from WMAP analysis alone, then finally, a little bit more about science. And I mainly focus on this paper, and in particular, just the inflation part, because this is the talk for the implications for inflation. But there are other things, of course, that we could learn from WMAP 5-year results. And I will mention a little bit about it as well. Okay. And this is the 5-year science team. So on your left, you have 7 people in red. So these are PI and core eyes of the WMAP missions. And then there are other people who joined the WMAP team after that. And then there are sort of kind of third generation people who were added after that. And WMAP has kind of system that young people come and go, get job, and graduate. So these are WMAP graduates, and I must emphasize that, of course, WMAP 5-year results are not independent of 3-year or first-year results. So our results we're presenting here, of course, also based upon the lot of work that these people have done in the past. So we're very pleased that we're kind of joining force together to get this out. So I had only 24 hours to prepare for the talk. So what I'm going to do is to essentially put plots together and talk about them. And hopefully you ask questions so that I don't miss out anything important to say. So we're gonna talk about, say, curvature of the universe. We're gonna talk about isocurvature. We're gonna talk about tilt. We're gonna talk about gravitational wave amplitude. We're gonna talk about inflation constraints on certain class of inflation models. And you might be curious about numbers first. So these are kind of numbers. NS, still less than 1 at 2.9 sigma. And R is now tightly constrained. I believe this is the best constraint that we have so far. And NS greater than 1 is now being disfavored. By the way, when I say ruled out in this talk, that means it's more than 3 sigma. When I say disfavored, I mean it's 2 sigma. So when I say hint, it could mean anything. All right. So NS greater than 1 is now disfavored regardless of the value of R, and I think there's some significance to it. Curvature continues to be consistent with 0, although the kind of accuracy that we're talking about is now very, very good. And we, for example, upper limit on omega k, the positive omega k means it's negatively curved universe. So if you like open universe model, negatively curved universe model, then we know that the curvature parameter has to be less than 1%. Yes? Yes? We impose, yeah, thanks for asking that. We are imposing the constraint on NT, so tensor tilt. So tensor tilt equals to minus R divided by 8. And that's the only constraint we're imposing. Mm-hmm. That would be actually very interesting to actually run chains with the other prior, like what you just said, and see what we get. That would be very interesting. Thank you. Yes, thank you. Now, there was also kind of, so when we do the curvature constraint, we usually assume that it is cosmological constant that we are seeing as a dark energy, but there has been number of claims that W is actually degenerate with curvature. So we decided to put the simultaneous constraint on W and omega k, and surprisingly, constraints are not that different. So I'll talk about that. So I'll get to that. Yes, that's right. So, and this thing called, I'm sure all of you know about this, but the entropy perturbation, so fluctuations may not be completely adiabatic. And now we're constraining them to high precision. And this is pretty impressive number to me. Finally, something about non-Gaussianity. Okay, so for the first year, for example, we had more like 30%. And now this is pretty good. We haven't done the isocurvature or entropy perturbation for the three-year data by ourselves, but there are other groups who have done it, and our limit is something like factor of 2 to 4 better than that. Okay. So this is kind of checklist, and I'm going to talk about these things in this order. So is the observable universe flat? If so, what will be the implication? How adiabatic the perturbations are, how Gaussian are they, and how scale invariant are they, and what about the amplitude of gravitational waves? And you know, this is the Nobel theories meeting, and of course, all model Nobel theories have to satisfy these observational constraints, I believe. But I guess these are pretty easy to satisfy anyway. Okay. All right. So that's the five-year data. This is the internal linear combination map. And visually, nothing has changed. We have a better calibration. So if you take the difference map between this and the previous map, you see some kind of feature, but that's not that significant. We continue to see SH here. That's pretty good. So, of course, before we get to this, we had to start from this. It's good to remind ourselves that we have this foreground. So K band, Ka band, Q band, V band, W band. So this is 20 gigahertz, 22, 33, 40, 61, 94 gigahertz. We have to take out this galaxy before we do the cosmological analysis, and we also do a masking to get rid of these foregrounds. So a basic procedure for cleaning the foreground hasn't changed since the three-year data. Essentially, we take external templates, such as the dust template from the measurement from other wavelengths, the infrared measurements, some millimeter measurements done by, so compiled by ThinkMiner et al. We also use the H-alpha tracers to map out the free emission. Then we use, now this K-band data is completely dominated by synchrotron. So if you take K-band and subtract Ka from the K, then you get rid of CMB, but still bulk of the synchrotron is left. So we use that as the trace of synchrotron. And these three components continue to explain bulk of the foreground emission that we see on the microwave sky. So for that reason, we don't use K or Ka for cosmological data analysis, because they were used to clean up the galaxy. Also, Q-band is not used, and we didn't use that for 3 years either. And we now have a different set of masks as well. So this is the upgrade to the masks since the first data release. And previously, we masked the sky using a K-band map. But it turns out that that mask, based upon K-band, leaves out some of the regions on the sky that has significant free flee. And because free flee tends to be more important on high frequency, if you use K, you miss out some of that. So as a result, we're releasing the mask for cosmological analysis. Both power spectrum analysis, we have one mask. For Gaussian key test, we have another mask. Both have been updated. And as a result, these masks are a little bit larger than the previous ones. I'll get to that. Has some impact on the non-Gaussian analysis. Okay. And polarization. So this is the polarization map. And you will continue to see beautiful galaxy in K-band. And we use this map to clean up the foreground in other channels. And we continue to use the same mask for the polarization. Now as you can see, Ka and Q, they still have some galactic foreground left. But in fact, we think now we understood the foreground emission in Ka, which is essentially entirely dominated by synchrotron emission. Well enough that now we can use Ka band for cosmological analysis. Okay? And at first sight, you know, this map might look horribly contaminated by a galaxy, but we essentially mask out much of them using the masks that we already developed in a third year release, and we subtract the foreground. We looked at, so I'll mention a little bit about it more later, but after subtraction of the galactic foreground from the polarization map, we see no trace of foreground to within the error bar of the data. Yes? Directionality. Along the hot spots and cold spots? Okay. Yeah, I'm sorry, you can't really see it, but there are arrows here, actually. Yeah, I'm sorry, but this goes like this. And essentially, yeah, so Milky Way has a disk, and dust, so magnetic field tends to go this way, and dust is lined up like that. Yeah, actually, you can't see them. Yeah, very clearly here, sorry. Now we use, therefore, Ka and Q and B band for cosmology analysis. For the 3 year, we didn't use Ka. We used only Q and B. So in addition to having more years of data, we now add Ka. So our polarization sensitivity has increased significantly. W band appears to contain some anomaly features that we probably think is the systematic error that we couldn't understand yet. So we continue to investigate that. We have some ideas about which directions to go, but we're expecting to be able to use that for the future data release. And there are a number of improvements that we have made since the 3 year data analysis, but there are a couple that I wanted to mention to you. The major improvement is beam. Now, let me just tell you a little bit more about it. When we measure microwave background power spectrum, right, that's a power spectrum smeared by a beam of the W band because we don't have infinite resolution. It's smeared out. We have to correct it back by using the knowledge of the beam. And we know the beam by measuring the planet Jupiter. Now, you measure planet Jupiter, no matter how bright the Jupiter is, there's always a noise of the W map. So you can integrate only down to certain level of the noise to map out the beam. As a result, as time goes by, or as we integrate longer, we have better map of Jupiter, therefore better understanding of the beam. But not only that, but also you can try to, because, okay, what is a beam shape? Where does that come from? It comes from shape of the mirror, frequencies, and distortions on the mirror. it's not Gaussian at all. So we can't use Gaussian beam profile. Now, because we are always somewhat noise dominated on the faint end of the beam, we have to use something else to supplement that the measured beam profile. And that requires extensive physical optical modeling. And that takes a lot of time. But we managed to do the physical optical modeling for both sides of beams. We have two mirrors. So we have done it for both sides for the first time since the initial release. As a result, we're pleased to say that now our beam uncertainty has been reduced by a factor of 2 to 4. That's very significant. Okay. Yes, for example, in most bands, beam error has been reduced by factor of 2. In some cases, like W band, error has been reduced by factor of 4. So that's very significant. The calibration. We calibrate off the CMB, off the CMB dipole, and we continue to do that. But we have, the way WMAP works is that WMAP sees some signal from the sky, and then there's some gain response to that that converts to thermodynamic temperature. We have to multiply some factor, so we have to multiply what we measure by some factor to convert it to CMB calibrated temperature. That conversion factor is always uncertain, so you have to know response of the instrument to be able to calculate that gain factor. And we have been doing pretty good job on that. So for example, calibration error has been always already 0.5% level. So we know that conversion factor to 0.5% level. We have improved algorithm for calculating that gain calibration, and now we're getting it down to even smaller level, 0.2%. But overall impact of gain calibration was not so large for the cosmological analysis. So beam was more important for the cosmos. And as I mentioned to you briefly, we now use more polarization data for cosmology. And let's see what it does for us. So this is a new beam, and it's a little bit busy plot, but okay, what you're seeing here is the following. You have red lines show you the one sigma, plus minus one sigma, of the beam from the 3-year, right? And our horizontal axis is the multiples. So it's 200 here, 4, 6, 8, and so forth. And what's plotted here is delta B over B, where B is the beam transfer function. Power spectrum is proportional to B squared. So if you see 1% here, say 0.01 here, 0.02 here, sorry that sort of number is hard to read, but that means you get 2% effect here for the power spectrum and 4% effect here for the power spectrum. The error on the beam has been sort of 2% level, I'm sorry, 1% level for the 3-year. Now we're reducing it to about 1% level. Now, there was a change from the 3-year beam to 5-year beam, thanks to this extensive physics optical modeling. So what you see in the black is the difference between 3-year beam and 5-year beam. Actually, 5-year beam minus 3-year beam. So here, 5-year beam is higher than 3-year beam by about 1%, for example. And this is K, K, A, Q, Q, B, B, W, 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 W. And we only use B and W for the temperature analysis. Okay, this is what we use for the power spectrum analysis. What that means is that, so if you look at these plots, these black curves are all consistent within one sigma from the 3-year beam error, which is nice. Nice to see that. So the results are consistent, but they are consistently higher by about 1%. So they would consistently raise the inferred power spectrum after correcting for the beam by about 2%. In fact, it's more like 2.5%. And raise is almost uniform in L above L about 200. So if you take power spectrum 5 year and compare that to 3 year on top of each other, then power spectrum will be raised about 2.5% uniformly across multiples greater than 200. Yeah. But that change is consistent with one sigma error of the beam. So the results, the cosmological results are statistically consistent with 3 year results. Yes? Yes, yes, that's right. Okay, yeah, yeah. So this correlation is something we can calculate precisely. And the way to think about it is that, for example, say you have a Gaussian beam, right? And then in that case, only factor that you have is the width of the beam. You change the width of the beam by one sigma because you know the functional form. You know exactly how to calculate the covariance. Because we know the beam shape, that's the measurement that we make. We know how to calculate a beam error in that way. So for example, you can try to decompose this beam error mode into, say, principal components. And then we use for top 10 significant modes to calculate the beam covariance and use that in likelihood code. Components are independent by definition, yeah, by construction. High L's are increased, yes. Any multiples above L of 200 are increased by 2.5%, about 2%. It's not that simple, actually, because NS is a tilt. But what you see is more like the uniform, you know, the multiples are almost uniformly raised. So that's not really what NS should be doing. Amplitude, for example, was influenced as well. So amplitude and NS are kind of things that would be affected. But results are actually pretty, you know, surprisingly similar to what we had before, which is a good thing. So this raise in the beam wasn't really correlated with, obviously correlated with the cosmological power. So this is the 5 year CL. And now we are cosmic variance limited up to about L of 530 here. And, but significant changes are also made on the measurement of the third peak. So for the 3 year results, we didn't really see much of the evidence for the third year at the third peak, but we have better measurement on that. And this place will continue to improve as we integrate more. And this has an effect for the determination of things like omega matter H squared in sigma H. Anything that's related to matter density will be improved by this. And there have been also better data coming from the ground-based experiments that go much beyond what WMAP could see in terms of angular resolution. And for example, there's a complete analysis of aqua data. That's this thing. And we have boomerang and CBI data as well, also plotted on top of this. And so the third peak region, black is still WMAP, aqua purple, and they seem to match up pretty well. So we have a consistent picture around the third peak. All right. So what about adding Ka? So here we're kind of switching to the polarization power spectrum. So you saw temperature power spectrum, this is the polarization. This is the polarization E power spectrum, and L plus one CL divided by 2 pi, as usual here in micro Kelvin squared, and this is multiple. So this is a very low L, as you can see, so 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. One thing I wanted to warn you is that at such low multiples, the distribution of CL is very non-Gaussian. So you are not allowed to multiply error by 2 to get 2 sigma. It's very, very skewed. So having said that, and this error also includes Coulson invariance, these are optimal estimates of the power spectrum at low L. You can do this exactly. And now, as you can see, this L equals 4 continues to be very significant. And if you add them together, add them up together, and try to fit it to the cosmological power spectrum, then this is the best fit that you can get. Black here is an upper limit, so we don't see anything here. Now, this is the sum of Ka band, 20 gigahertz, and QMV, 40 to 60 gigahertz. We don't use W90 because there's something that we don't understand there. So these are the combination. Now what happens, okay, the biggest worry in Ka is the foreground. Do we understand foreground well enough in Ka? And we know that most of the foreground in Ka is coming from synchrotron. So what if we take the difference? And that should be completely dominated by foreground if there is residual foreground in Ka. What we see is just zero signal, straight. We don't see any evidence for any excess signal here. So that's pretty good. But yeah. In fact, thank you. Ka plus Q plus V divided by 2 divided by 2. And this thing as well, Ka minus Q plus V divided by 2 divided by 2. So that the error bars are the same in both, more or less the same. Yeah. Now, that's the power spectrum, but what's most interesting for us from the low L power spectrum in E is the measurement of the optical depth of the universe to lateral scattering surface. And that was used to sort of infer the reionization epoch. So what you see is an estimate of the optical depth coming from the E power spectrum only. What you see here in red is an estimate from QV. Okay? And what's shown in blue is an estimate from KA. It's broader because it's a little bit noisier, but they're consistent. And the KA QV is the sum, right? K minus Q plus V divided by 2 divided by 2. This is the null. This is the difference, the tau measured from difference map. And it's zero. So there's no sign of any foreground contamination as long as within a kind of error that we have. There's no evidence for the residual foreground. So we can include Ka in the cosmology analysis now. This is a measurement of tau from Fibia. We have 5 sigma, in fact, more than 5 sigma detection of tau. Not even particle physicists can call this detection. We had a 3 sigma before. And now, I don't talk about this very much because this is the implication for inflation, but the one significant conclusion we made from this measurement of tau now is that if you assume instantaneous reionization redshift is 11, plus minus 1.4, and that excludes an instantaneous reionization at z equals 6 at 3.5 sigma. So quasar absorption observations suggested that the reionization was ending at z equals 6. But now we can say that the reionization didn't happen instantaneously at z equals 6. It had to be prolonged episode of reionization. Now we can say that. Okay. But significance of tau measurement is not just reionization, but it has an implication for NS as well. Tau suppresses the power on small scales. That could be correlated with NS, because NS is a tilting. So there is a positive correlation between NS and tau. So the larger the tau is, the larger the NS becomes. But with the 5-year determination of optical depth, we we kind of got rid of that degeneracy to the level that is now subdominant degeneracy. Interestingly, it is now omega value h squared that limits our NS measurement. So unless we have a better measurement of omega value h squared, it will be a little bit difficult to improve upon measurement of NS. Now, why that is that, so if you, for example, change omega value h squared, the first place, first multiple that will change will be the second peak. But we have a very good measurement of second peak, so that's not the limiting factor. The limiting factor now is a damping tail. If you raise omega value h squared, then you get more damping, silicon damping on smaller scales. That's what's limiting us. Unless we have a better measurement of silicon damping, it will be difficult to improve upon this significantly. Now, WMAP alone results indicates that it's this value, something like 0.96 for NS, and that's 2.5 sigma away from NS equals 1 if you use this marginalized one-dimensional distribution. So this is NS likelihood, and this is NS equals 1. So that's kind of on the tail of the distribution. Or if you're willing to take the two-dimensional distribution, then you say NS is still consistent with 1 at 2 sigma level. But in that case, omega value h squared will be 0.024. So if someone tells us that omega value h squared is in fact 0.023, then that's here. So that's the kind of numbers that we're playing with now. So omega value h squared of plus minus 0.001 sort of determines the error bar of the NS. And the Big Bang nucleosynthesis can provide us with some information about omega value h squared, but it turns out that the best error bar is still kind of larger than the kind of error bar we have for WMAP. So maybe that's one direction one can go. The other direction one can go is to use, say, small scale CMB measurements to improve upon the measurement of damping tail. Thanks for asking that. So we looked at ACVAR, new complete data sets that trace damping tail very well, as well as other CMB measurements. They actually don't improve on the measurement of NS. Error bars are about the same. Probably that's because of the amplitude, the calibration uncertainty. So you are sort of, because of the calibration certain on small scale measurements, the overall normalization can go up and down. And that can easily mimic the effect of NS. So because of that, the small scale measurement don't seem to improve upon NS very much. But that situation should change in the future. Yes? It's not included, that's right. Right, that is correct, yes. Yeah, that was just simple vanilla minimal six parameter lambda CDM. Okay, now how do we test our universe models? So, I gave you sort of brief overview of the changes that we made in analysis. And thanks for being patient. Now we talk about implications. Okay, so how do we test models? WMAP data alone can put tight limits on most of the checklist. For example, NS, we already saw that we have a pretty good measurement of NS now from WMAP alone. But on the other hand, we can also do better by combining WMAP with other data sets. There are two measurements that we would like to use this time in particular. These are the measurements of distances. There are other data sets that trace, so say, for example, amplitude of fluctuations, say weak lensing, and amplitude of galaxy power spectrum, amplitude of Lyman alpha forest. We don't use those. We wanted to separate out the contributions from amplitude and contributions from distance. So the idea here is to see how far we can go by just using distance information, measured by baryon acoustic oscillation distribution in galaxies in type 1 and supernova. They measure luminosity distances, and this thing measures angular lambda distances. In this way, it's very easy to tell where the improvements are coming from. And if there is any tension, there's a clue as to what to look for and how to fix them. Now, one example in which these measurements help you is, for example, the flatness of the universe. And this is kind of a dramatic plot. So what's shown here is the curvature parameter, omega k, 0, minus 0.1, minus 0.2, and so forth, and omega lambda. And this is doubling up a long constraint. And this is long degeneracy. It's pretty easy to understand why, because doubling up measures, so for the flatness, doubling up essentially measures angular diameter distance to z equals 1090. Now, that's sensitive to curvature, but it's not only the curvature that determines angular lambda distance. You have omega matter, you have omega lambda, you have h0, you have w. So, therefore, single measurement of the angular lambda distance is a single redshift. It's not going to get you good measurement of omega k. You need to have at least two absolute distance indicators. HSD, Hubble constant measurement, for example, that sets absolute distance scale in the universe. So that effectively affects as an absolute distance indicator. So if you combine HSD, then error shrinks like that. This is the blow up of this region. So HSD measurement is about this. So just by adding HSD measurement, Hubble constant, 72 plus minus 8, you get this improvement. You can add a supernova, and you get this blue contour, dark blue. Or you add a BL, okay? Separately from HST or supernova, you get red. I tell you what I mean by BL data in the next slides, but the information I want to deliver from this plot is that since BL is an absolute distance indicator, and supernova are relative distance indicators, BL is more powerful in constraining the curvature. So BL measurements and CMB measurements of angular lambda distances essentially fix omega k. You can combine supernova, BL, and WMAP to get purple here, but that's essentially the same as this red here. So WMAP plus BL plus supernova is essentially the same as BL plus WMAP. And that's the kind of accuracy that we have for omega k. This is one-dimensional distribution. I'll come back to the numbers in a minute. So what kind of data that we are using here? So type 1a supernova. There are three data sets available now. Reese et al. HSC data. It's known as sort of Reese Gold sample, 2004, 2006. And then there's a supernova legacy survey data sets. And then essence datasets that cover a relative range about 0.02 to something like 1.7. And this is the magnitude of the supernova relative to the theoretical model that assumes empty universe. So omega matter equals 0, omega k equals, equals 1, omega lambda equals 0. Right. This excess here is an indication the universe is accelerating, but we have more data here. And this is the best fit lambda CD. Okay. So this is the data that we use for the supernova and the barium acoustic oscillations. Okay. So you saw CMB power spectrum that has oscillations in it. That oscillation came from interaction between photons and baryons at z equals 1090. Because baryons also oscillate, you have the imprint of oscillations in the matter power spectrum as well, and that you can measure that from galaxy power spectrum. If you take away smooth component of the power spectrum and just try to look for oscillation only, this is what you get. So this is the 2DF plus SDSS main sample data sets, and they measure oscillations traced by galaxies at z equals 0.2. There's another data set called the luminous red galaxies measured from Sloan Digital Sky Survey that measures oscillations traced at z equals 0.35. These oscillations are set in at redshift of about 1020, because decoupling epoch for baryons and decoupling epoch for photons are slightly different. You can read more about it in my paper. But the key point is that CMB measures angular lambda distances to z equals 1090. You can use this BAL measurement to measure angular lambda distance to z equals 0.2. And you can use this measurement to measure angular lambda distance to 0.35, z equals 0.35. So we have three data points in angular lambda distance, all absolute distance indicators, z equals 0.2, z equals 0.35, and z equals 1000. Whereas for supernova, we have a more densely sampled luminosity distances between z of 0.02 and 1.7. So they're highly complementary. They're complementary also that the supernova data are relative distance indicators. They are not sensitive to the absolute distances, so there are some differences as well. And they become, this difference becomes important when we talk about constraining the models. As a result of all that, this is a kind of estimate for omega k if we don't allow w to vary. So it's cosmological constant. And the constraint driven mostly by W map plus BAL, and BALs are more powerful in this model because they are absolute distance indicators. Yes. That's very true, yes. So, for example, thanks for pointing that out. So we don't actually use these data points as they are. So they provide distance measurements that they made from these data sets. So, well, I think they take into account these window function effects. Window function effect, you mean, you talk about it's a geometrical effect, right? The masking, yeah. So that's right. And we just, well, hopefully they do the correct analysis in terms of inferring the distancing from these oscillations. I think the overall shape of the power spectrum, as opposed to oscillations, would be more sensitive to window function effect. But I think the phase of oscillations, essentially what's important here is that the phase of oscillation is what gives you the distance scales, and not the sort of tilting or overall amplitude. So phases are less sensitive to systematic errors like nonlinearity in window functions. So I think, well, yes. Okay. I see, I see. Okay, I would like to know about it, yes. Yeah, let's talk about it later. That's a good point. Okay, now what if we let W vary, right? After all, we don't know what the W is really. And then you get something like this. So now you're seeing the omega K here versus W. And W map isn't really able to constrain it very well by itself. But if you combine that with BL and supernova, you get this shrinkage of error by many orders of magnitude. Now here you see sort of interesting thing. So absolute distance indicators like HSD still helps. And it kind of helps in the direction of fixing omega K. BAL as well. BAL primarily fixes curvature once it's combined with W. But it doesn't do much for W because their redshift coverage is narrow and they are not densely sampled. To get the handle on W, you really need to have a densely sampled distance indicators. That's where supernova helps. And the supernova's constraint is a kind of tilted way from this BAL that once you combine them, you get tight constraint. Now, it's kind of, but But if you just take you look at this plot, right, you see that this combination here, although they touch here, they barely touch. Right? So you might be worried, you know, or you might be excited. This may be some indication of new physics, or maybe you're looking at some unaccounted systematic error. So to check that, we wanted to see how sensitive you are to the exact form of BAL priors. After all, BAL gives you this degeneracy curve. And after all, actually, this degeneracy curve is all we need. We don't really need to have more than that. So we use a subset of BAL. So this is a combination of three BAL measurements at two redshifts. This BAL measurement here is a subset of that. So this is only using luminous redshift to get luminous red galaxies at redshift of 0.35. We don't use 0.2 data. Then it's relaxed a little bit, and it's extending out farther to W of more positive W. But degeneracy line doesn't really change, and as a result, constraints that we're getting don't change. In other words, constraints we're getting are not sensitive to the exact form of the BAL prior. As long as they give us correct degeneracy line, we don't seem to be very sensitive to that. Where? Here. Oh, you have to remember, these are not independent. You have WMAP in both. Right. Yeah. Yeah. You can't just multiply these two contours. OK, now what's the interpretation? So much about omega k. What's a big deal? Nothing is a big deal, but it's fun to actually calculate the foreign quantity. Want to teach in class. Omega k, what is omega k? By definition, omega k actually is related to curvature radius of the universe. This is the relation. Okay. Before omega k was invented, this was what people were using. And that's something like c over h naught divided by square root of omega k. You plug in our constraints, of course, omega k, you know, is can go negative and positive, and of course there's a typo here. It's zero, not one. Omega k positive means negatively curved. The omega k negative means positive. Well, whatever. Okay. negatively curved in space, your curvature radius has to be bigger than 33 H inverse gigaparsec. It's fun to compare that to particle horizon today. That's about 9.7 H inverse gigaparsec for the same model that we consider here. So the observable universe is pretty flat. At least we don't have any sign of the curvature radius anywhere close to even particle horizon today. So that's kind of fun number to quote in the class when you teach cosmology. Implications of inflation. Because we don't see any evidence for the curvature radius, you might wonder, okay, so therefore inflation had to last for a certain number of e-folds. Can we say anything about it? Details aside, you can look up the argument that's made in the paper. It's a fairly straightforward argument. Then, of course, there's uncertainty about when inflation ended, but if you take reheating temperature to be something like 1 TeV, you'll get this. Factor of 10 improvement in omega k will raise this to 337. Factor of two order of magnitude improvement get you to something like 38. So, you know, improvement is minor, and obviously you're completely dominated by the reheating constraint. But, you know, if we see curvature, this is the kind of n total we're talking about. And if we believe, for example, that fluctuation that we see today came from n of, say, 50 or 60, that will automatically put the constraint on reheating temperature. So that would be interesting to see if the omega k is indeed fact. But this is the kind of thing that you would want to check when you come up with a new novel theory of early universe. Okay, thanks for asking that. So we took integer curvature to be unity. So omega k at the beginning of inflation is 1. So not, you know, not too small, not too large. So that will give you the logarithmic correction, depending on the omega k initial. Okay, what about adiabaticity? I better actually speed up. So let's see. So this is adiabatic relation. So radiation density fluctuation related to matter disruption this way. And there's one number just I wanted to know, which is how much deviation are we allowed to have for adiabatic? And the simple, truly simple-minded way to characterize that is to just use a minus b divided by a plus b divided by 2. Fractional deviation. So I define this delta adif, which we call adiabatic deviation parameter, or anything you want to have a name for. And then that's essentially a minus b divided by a plus b divided by 2. So if we have delta adif, that's say 0.02, that means temperature and matter fluctuation obey adiabatic relation to 2%. Now, where does the constraint come from? So this is the TE power spectrum from 5-year data analysis. And we see a clear dip, very significant dip here, and also a dip here. Okay. And this is, by the way, new from 5-year analysis. Now, what does this non-adiabatic perturbation do? Is that so non-adiabatic perturbations have the oscillations that are out of phase. So when it's zero, it's maximum for ice curvature, or adiabatic, non-adiabatic perturbation. So what it does is essentially, if you add non-adiabatic perturbations, it will shift the zeros, and it will fill in troughs, right? So that's what it does. And thanks to the improvement that we have made in the temperature polarization power spectrum, now we have a very good measurement on the constraint on the non-adiabatic perturbations. Just a kind of the detailed point. So although I talked about this delta adi, there is another quantity that people talk about it in the literature, which is the entropy perturbation squared divided by curvature perturbation squared. And that happens to be, okay, that's called alpha. That happens to be related to delta adi by 9 times delta adi squared. So we can just convert them each other. And two scenarios. So you get different constraints depending upon how entropy perturbation is related to adiabatic perturbation. They could be completely uncorrelated. They could be completely correlated or anti-correlated. Axion type, for example, and I have this name axion type just to mean that entropy perturbations and curvature perturbations are completely uncorrelated. And that's the kind of thing that you expect from axion. There's another class we call curvaton type, which has an anti-correlation between entropy perturbation and curvature perturbations. Well, it could be correlated depending on the sign convention that you have to R, but that's explained in the paper. But in any case, you get different answers depending on two cases. And now, however, in both scenarios, and we're assuming that almost scaling invariant spectrum for both of the adiabatic perturbations and non-adiabatic perturbations. Because they're scaling invariant, these ice curvature perturbations tend to produce power on low L, say L less than 100. So it's just like tensor mode. It's just a gravity wave that will be degenerate with NS. And that degeneracy can be actually broken by adding BL and supernova. So this is the constraint on axion type. So now we use alpha here. And this is the alpha for axion and NS. And you see massive degeneracy. But that degeneracy happens to be just with omega matter h squared. By changing omega matter h squared, you are also changing the amplitude of third peak. And that happens to be degenerate with NS. So by having some independent measurements of omega matter h squared, you can narrow it down. You can reduce this degeneracy. And in turn, that will influence the contour on NS and alpha plane. So as a result, by adding BL and supernova, you get factor of more than 2 improvement. That we haven't really done, but we can check it. I assume that actually probably these are comparable in terms of constraining omega matter X squared, I think. But I don't know the exact numbers. WMAP only constraint, by the way, is already a factor of 2 better than the previous constraint. So TE, beta TE measurement does help. In terms of this adiabatic deviation parameter, you see it's 8.6% measurement or constraint on the entropy perturbation from axiom. Sure. Okay, so here we assume that adiabatic perturbation has a tilting NS, and we assume a completely scanning invariant spectrum for axial perturbation. The reason for that is that, and there's a reason why we call these axion perturbations. So in order for axion model to be compatible with the constraint for omega matter X squared and stuff like that, energy scale of inflation tends to be very low. So that tends to produce very small gravitational waves. Therefore, in this kind of model, slower order parameter epsilon tends to be very small. So axion perturbations are almost scale invariant. And adiabatic perturbations still care about eta, not just epsilon. So it's self-consistent in that way. We have some implications for axion cosmology if you would like to read about it. No. Okay, because axion perturbations, the axion perturbations just like gravitational waves in terms of the spectrum. The N axion depends only on epsilon, not eta. Yeah. And carbon type, we have different constraints because now we have a different kind of correlation between axion and adiabatic perturbation. And in this case, we're assuming same tilt, same NS for a carbon perturbation and inflaton perturbation. And it's the same story. Then constraint is something like 2%. These are pretty good measurements, I think. We're getting down to really percent level accuracy for adiabaticity. So percent on flatness, a couple of percent, or maybe 8% on adiabaticity. What about Gaussianity? There's a workshop focused only on non-Gaussianity immediately following this one, so I don't talk much about it. And I didn't have time to write about it in the slides, so let me just present numbers. Primarily, we're using angular bias spectrum. We also use so-called Minkowski functionals. I'm going to present that in the workshop for non-Gaussianity. But what we measure is essentially this triangle. And there are many triangles that you can look for. So we tailored an estimator such that we are sensitive to only certain class of triangles that are physically motivated. So one is so-called local form, or squeeze the triangle like that. And the other is equilateral form, like that. And you will hear a lot about what they mean in the non-Gaussian workshop. But essentially, there are two parameters characterizing the amplitude of these two triangles. You call that FNL. And we didn't see detection. So 2 sigma range contains 0 for both of these parameters. Now, what do these numbers actually mean? They actually mean that magnitude of non-Gaussianity is actually 0.1% level. Although these numbers seem big, that's because the way that these parameters are defined. But they actually mean that the fluctuations of Gaussianity is 0.1% level. That's actually better than adiabaticity or flatness. So Gaussianity clearly offers you very strong constraints on the non-Gaussianity, on the theory of our universe. These numbers are based upon the new galaxy mask, by the way, that I just mentioned. Cuts slightly more sky than the previous one. And some of that FNL might come from point source contaminations, so I subtracted that. that's about 2 for local and about 20 for equilateral. That's a detail that I will talk more about in the subsequent workshop. Now, new mask is KQ, a little bit about mask. So this new mask cuts slightly more sky. So it only retains something like 72% of the sky. And KP0 mask that we have been using previously retains more sky, something like 76.5%. Because we are using larger mask, error in FNL obviously increases. But if we did use previous mask, and I must say, there wasn't really anything wrong with previous mask. The current mask is certainly more conservative. We're removing free regions slightly more. But in terms of the cosmological analysis, they don't really make much of a difference. So aren't we not seeing anything because we are increasing the error? And that's entirely possible. So we tried KP0 mask, and this is the number. And you see the upper limit is actually the same, right? 111, it's 111. It is the lower limit that has changed. Why is that? Because error bar is smaller for larger, it's a smaller mask. If you take this mask, therefore, there's a hint for the FN greater than 0. But we have a reason to use KQ75. We can't just arbitrarily take KP0. So we believe that this is the number. I mean, KQ75 number is the kind of best estimate that we can make right now. It will be interesting to see if this signal persists with this mask with more data. And we say, for example, 9 years of data that we're currently proposing to NASA, we will have something like 3 sigma. Let's talk about, yeah. So that problem has been solved, right? Yeah. Okay. So to follow up on that, and we also have KQ85 created in exactly the same manner, but it cuts less sky. It retains something like 82% of the sky. You actually have a similar, actually exactly the same number for FNL for that. So it's not just that effect, actually. All right, now what about scale invariance? So WMAP only gave this number. And if you add BA on supernova, you get something like 2.9 sigma. Yes. Very good question. I don't know. Probably what's going to happen in the end is that we see some evidence for FNL from bispectrum. What we should be doing then is not to create a mask that will get rid of it, but measure the same thing using different statistics, say Minkowski functions or trispectrum. Then see if they actually agree. Or if we have enough signal-to-noise ratio, we can break up the triangles into pieces and see where that signal is actually coming from. So more detailed analysis would be the thing that we should be doing at that point. So far, we've been measuring only one number. But that doesn't really give you much information about what's really going on. We haven't measured trispectrum yet. Yes, that's work to do. Yeah. Now, so speaking about the NS, there wasn't much improvement from WMAP only to BA plus supernova, and that's actually easy to understand because dominant correlation is coming from omega baryon squared, and none of these BA or supernova sensitive to omega baryon squared. So we need something else to improve on that. No running index. So power law spectrum is essentially a good fit. I should mention that a simple model like m squared, phi squared actually does produce running at the level of 10 to the minus 3, which is 10 times smaller than we are sensitive to right now. So we are still consistent with the standard picture. but within our error bar, running is not significant. What about gravitational waves? And let's see. Let me just remind you how WMAP constrains gravitational waves first. It is often said that B mode, right? B mode is a thing that you measure and constrain gravitational waves. But B mode, okay, tensor modes, gravitational waves actually produce also E mode and temperature as well. So, what if we use only polarization power spectrum? What if we use only B mode power spectrum, E mode power spectrum, and TE correlation below L equals 20 or so? Then, this is what we find. R less than 20. So polarization are not that sensitive to R yet from that. But what's interesting is that if you take, say, R equals 10 here, then that enormous amount of R produces a significant negative correlation TE here. That's totally inconsistent with data. So by just increasing the maximum multiple for TE to, say, L of 450, you improve on the measurement of R by an order of magnitude. Okay. And this part of the spectrum actually improves as we collect more data. So by using polarization data alone, we might be able to sensitive to interesting level of R. But then, very significant improvement comes from the temperature. Because tensor modes adds power to L less than 50 or so. This is what happens when R is 10. It's just completely inconsistent with what you see here. Now, from TE, you see R less than 2, but that's still pretty inconsistent with what we see on a large scale. Then by including this information, we can get down to R less than 0.2. But this argument fixes all the other parameters, so R less than 0.2 is not our best estimate, because R is correlated with NS. So if we do the full analysis, this is what you get, and R less than 0.43 is the WMAP only limit, okay? Degeneracy between NS and R increases error by a factor of 2. Relative to the simple argument I presented there. Now, once again, this is a very similar story to the ice curvature perturbations. You see this massive correlation, but the part of that correlation actually comes from correlation between omega mod I squared and NS. So by adding BL and NS, I'm sorry, supernova, and again, it'd be interesting to see how much of that is coming from BL or supernova. You shrink this degeneracy. As a result, you shrink the error constraint. And once you do that, you get R less than 0.2. And that's the most stringent limit to date. But what was most interesting to me when I looked at this was that it's not just R, right? R is correlated with an S. And in fact, NS greater than 1 is now disfavored regardless of the value of R. I mean, it used to be the case that NS greater than 1 could be allowed once you have a large gravitational waves. But not anymore. Disfavored means 2 sigma. If you wanted to find the maximum possible NS right now within 2 sigma, then that's here, NS 1.005. Okay. So it's fair to say that NS greater than 1.0 is this paper. And that's going to improve as we collect more data. So kind of we are lowering a limbo bar. And now many, many impression models are begin to be disfavored. And this is a sort of, probably very familiar to you, many of you, plot showing you R here and NS. And actually, if you look at the first year paper, it's like, it's here. Now the scale of this plot is very small. The top limit, this upper limit, is actually 0.4. Right? And here, it's 1.02 NS. So we're talking about very tiny parameter space. And lambda phi to the fourth is completely out. It's so far away that we can't even calculate significance using Markov chain. We don't have any points there. M squared phi squared is still within 2 sigma, but they are outside of 1 sigma region. They're still consistent. And now, there was this interesting paper by Isser and McAllister about prediction for NS from inflation model where you have a number of axioms. And they claim that although tensor amplitude doesn't change, NS actually changes by something like 25%. If you take that at face value, then NS will be shifted to the left. And this point here that corresponds to inflation model, m squared phi squared, with a number of e-folds of 50, that's now outside of, pushed outside of 95% confidence level. But this kind of monomial potential is not the only potential that you can produce large R, but also you can produce large R by having parallel inflation, or exponential potential. And so you have this A that goes like P to the P, and P less than 60 is out at more than 3 sigma. P less than 70 is on the verge, or it's outside of 95% region, and P 120 is right up here. You can reinterpret this as saying that, okay, what if you have actually many fields, instead of one field, many fields, each having P equals 1. Then this can be translated into the number of fields that you need. That's kind of inflation, or assisted inflation model by Andrew Little and collaborators. You need 120 fields if you wanted to see it that way. Blue spectrum tends to be produced by, yes? Any inflation? Yes. Yes. Okay. I'm sorry, yeah. So this inflation, that inflation are different models. If N fields have exponential potentials, then this is what you get, yeah. But if they have M scale, phi scale instead, this is what you get. Now, what about blue spectrum? Because we're now disfavoring blue spectrum, regardless of R, what kind of interesting thing we can say? We can say that if you take, say, hybrid inflation model, I don't have the potential written anywhere, actually, I'm sorry. But there's a parameter space in which hybrid inflation model will produce blue spectrum, and that's that. And that's essentially the region in which inflation is driven by vacuum term rather than mass term. If inflation is driven by mass term, then it's essentially identical to chaotic inflation. So you are here and you are happy. But if you are driven by constant term, you're out. Well, disfavored, but more than 2 sigma level. Dark orange is 1 sigma, light orange is 2 sigma. Yes. It's difficult, but the standard versions of all of these models will produce very small amount of non-Gaussian that are compatible with those ratios. So I think we can't really constrain that very well. But you can put, for example, different class of models that will produce large non-Gaussian. They will produce kind of different parameter space here. But to my knowledge, these models that will produce large non-Gaussian tend to produce very small R. So these models cannot be constrained very well by this R and S plane. But the things might change in the future. What if we put everything in, running NS, R, weak, constraints are weakened, of course. That's all I say. All right, so this is the summary. flatness to this level, not even assuming W equals minus 1. Normal adiabaticity less than 9% for axion, less than 2% for curvature. Non-Gaussianity is this, if you take KQ75 mask. Tilt, if you don't have R, this is what you have. Running, there's no evidence for running to within 2 sigma. Gravitational wave amplitude has been constrained very significantly better than before. And NS greater than 1 is favored. So this is the kind of one side summary of what I just said. And this is the scorecard from the 5-year WMAP. Looking ahead, so far, well, it's good to have the beta constraints, but no major discoveries. Okay. With more years of data, do we expect to have any kind of surprises? Non-Gaussianity could be one possibility. So KQ85, KP0, they seem to indicate that FNL is not zero. In fact, it's something like 60. But we can't tell that for sure because data is still limited. We need more data. With 9 years of data, 1 sigma error for FNL is projected to be 20. So if FNL is indeed 60, then we're going to have 3 sigma. Okay. Gravitational wave amplitude constraint will improve. And maybe m squared phi squared will be pushed outside of 95% level. If m squared phi squared is not the right model. If it is the right model, we're probably able to see evidence for that. So that would be a very good thing to know. NS greater than 1 will probably be convincingly ruled out with more years of data. So this is the kind of example that you can do with more years of data for inflation. There are other things that you can do with more data for other science. For example, I only talk about inflation, but kind of advertisements. We also talked a lot about dark energy. And I just loved, for example, you know, this easy to use supernova module or distance measurements from BAO. They just physically measured values, and that's very easy to use. So we decided to sort of provide a set of WMAP distance priors. We're going to give you acoustic scale, so the peak position measurement, that's written in terms of angular lambda distance and sound horizon. And also ratio of the Hubble horizon and angular lambda distance at decoupling. And also decoupling redshift, that depends on omega barium 8 squared. With these three values, and combined with other distance measurements, you can constrain dark energy models without having to go through all this time-consuming Markov chain. And we show in this paper that this distance information alone contains most of the information about dark energy. It's a little bit weaker constraint than the full analysis, of course, but you don't lose much. We also use the TB and EB correlations that are usually expected to vanish in a parity-conserving universe, but you can sort of play with it and say, how much parity violation are we allowed to have in the universe? And we do something about it. Now, if you have any early universe model that will violate parity, you can now constrain that using the derivative likelihood code. So I'm pleased to be able to say that. And there's something about neutrinos as well. I stop here. Thank you very much. We haven't specifically looked for it, but I expect that all of these will be present in the 5-year data as well, because not much has changed to large scale models. So these are the measurements that are coming from place of the power spectrum that's completely cosmic and unlimited. So there won't be any change in those on large scales. So I would expect them to be present. So we rather wanted to focus on something that we can improve with more years of integration. because that's where new things will pop up. Yeah. So three numbers are ratio of the sign horizon at the decoupling to angular diameter distance to the decoupling. And the ratio of the Hubble horizon and the angular diameter distance. This is, by the way, usually called shift parameter. So approach parameter. And redshift of decoupling. So that's 1090 plus minus something. And that depends on omega baryon and omega matter h squared. So the effective acts like prior on omega matter h squared and omega baryon h squared. So these three values are what you can use. Okay, we used, so for the curvature constraints, maybe it's more clear to you when I just give you the references. so this is from Percival et al. This is the latest determination of BLs combining 2DF and SDSS. This is from the Eisenstein et al. 2005. This is the original, the measurement. So this is purely a subset of that. That's right, yeah. This is using all. Yeah, this is using all subset. Well, so this includes also LLG, right? Oh, yeah. Because that was what was available. We didn't have a value coming just from main or 2DF. Yeah. Thank you.